Hello.
Hi, Michael, can you hear us? It's Kevin from Indie Live Radio.
I can hear you, yeah.
Good stuff. I'm here with Greg McCarra from the Scottish Independence Foundation. He was...
Fantastic.
Hi, Michael. Nice to hear you again.
Hey, you too.
Very kind to come in and co-host with me this morning, lastminute.com special show we're doing, Michael. So it's the Boris and Scottish Independence show special, right? So tell me, you're always a good man to ask, right? What's your thoughts on what's going on, the new cabinet we've got, Boris, etc.?
Well, I suppose I'm underwhelmed.
Yeah.
I think the worse it gets, the more predictable it feels to me personally, and I suppose to many of the people who invested so much time, hope and energy in 2014 and the year leading up to it. If anything, it's managed to surpass even my own pessimistic attitudes towards the state of British politics, which is saying something. My sort of wider fear is questioning how much that really will play through into the wider public, the people that are less politically engaged day to day. There's a risk that those people, the public in general, are kind of subdued and almost accepting of powerlessness, of being sort of passive to this circus that's going on down at Westminster. And you know, people, when they're feeling disempowered, don't necessarily have a lot of confidence in the country and the ability to do something different in Scotland. So I think that's the main challenge that this is, the independence movement.
Michael, can I ask you something? There's always a danger with the kind of scenario we've got just now, that people just get so frustrated, so angry with it, they just turn their faces away from it, don't pay any attention and don't follow what's happening. A year or so ago, led a wonderful project. My organisation helped to fund it. It was the Scotia Project. And yeah. I know who you were aiming at, who you were trying to reach and what you were trying to say, but how does the situation just now relate to young people and their engagement in politics, and what can and should be done?
Well, I think thanks for mentioning the Scotia Project again. Actually,
that was brilliant.
To get some of that up and running again in the next few weeks. Actually, to look at
That is good news. That is super
very good,
good
news.
News.
Glad to hear that.
To look at in particular how we can inject a bit of sort of confidence, a bit of energy, a bit of activity into the stuff myself and Robert Somley. We're doing in terms of some journalism, in terms of just like holding some events and putting out some new work that's got a slightly different approach to all the great projects and platforms and media groups that are already out there doing good work for independence. I think young people in general tend to be far more opposed to the Conservative government. They seem to be far more sort of angry as it stands about the state of the political establishment, and I think there's a few reasons for that that are largely economic in nature, relating back to the 2008 crisis. And I could speak at length actually about how that related to a lot of support for independence. A lot of the people that were brought into the independence movement from of those that were kind of under the age of 35 or under the age of 30 had already been involved in a lot of campaigning against austerity or against the tuition fees tripling that was brought in by Nick Clegg. And we're the same generation who have obviously seen their pay stagnating at the same time. Things like house prices have often priced them out of the same life goals the previous generations were often able to take for granted. So that culture, that economic position that there's been for the last decade makes the younger generation often ripe to support movements for political change if they can be communicated in an effective way. So I think that was something the independence movement has previously managed to tap into quite effectively. I think obviously the Boris Johnson election and this election of his cabinet and obviously the questions around Brexit all amplify that even further.
The first of your programmes on the Scotia Project was about housing, and you just touched on it there. If you're thinking of doing any other work in the near future, are you at liberty to give us an idea, a heads up, on what area you might be looking at?
Yeah, I think we're at first wanting to maybe bring down the scope and the size a little bit. We're very obviously ambitious, as you know, with managing to put on sort of live documentary events with live studio audiences participating, which was a good challenge for people that hadn't done that sort of work before. So I think to begin with, we'll probably go a little bit smaller scale and just building up sort of regular output, about maybe having some interviews, some guests, and focusing more on sort of quality film output as well, which is something that can be very, very popular. So, yeah, watch this space.
I can think of several people that would like to talk to you about that. I guess we might be having a conversation sometime soon. What do you think, Michael?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Look forward to that.
This is a great example, actually, of SIFF in action, isn't it? Scottish Independence Foundation, you know, helping projects happen within the independence movement.
There's lots of strong voices out there talking to different sections of the community. We're not going to win independence by just persuading one sector of Scottish society to swing behind it. We've got to reach out to everybody everywhere. And certainly you've been doing precisely that, you and Robert. It's nice to hear you getting back into action again maybe sometime soon.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I think that's the main message actually to take from Boris Johnson's election, is not to get bogged down in kind of negativity and cynicism and kind of a sense of hopelessness, but instead for it to be a platform to speak to people about the positive arguments for independence. I don't think people are going to embrace independence out of a sense of despair. You know, some people might support it out of a sense of frustration, especially if they're very pro-European Union, you know, if they're EU citizens that have moved here, and it might turn to independence for a sense of security. But I think the main challenge is to strengthen the positive arguments, especially on the economy, and to just speak to more and more people. The most common concern I always hear from people who aren't that engaged politically is just the simple, can we afford it? Can we do it? How's this going to work? How's that going to work? And I think often that comes back to a lack of confidence in Scotland's financial position, the diversity of our economy, and just sort of the capacity of governance. And those of us who already have that sense of confidence have a great responsibility now to make that case softly, gradually, with respect for those that disagree with us or are as yet unpersuaded. But I think that is the main challenge, not to sort of come down all sort of fire and brimstone and say, you know, the end is nigh. Because I think, sadly, I don't think there is a silver bullet. I don't think that you know, one more bad government at Westminster is all it takes to convince a strong majority to support independence. I think it's far deeper than that, and it goes to the very sort of confidence, or often lack of confidence, in Scotland's abilities, and that's our challenge.
Because negative campaigning just doesn't win people over, it turns them off, and a good, positive, upbeat message could be great. Michael, let me get personal for a minute. I think it was last summer you graduated, and congratulations on that, your law degree. And, of course, you're doing what apprentice lawyers always do, which is you've got another bit of work to do before you're set loose entirely in the world. I'm interested in how does that tie in with your passion for Scottish independence, the fact that you're going to be operating in an independent Scottish legal system, but it doesn't have jurisdiction over everything that maybe you would like it to. How do these things tie together?
First of all, I suppose my passion for politics was the reason I've gone and done a law degree.
Right.
I think there's obviously a lot of crossover between the two areas. If you care a lot about politics or public policy or how what's passed in the Scottish Parliament or the UK Parliament, it can be quite useful to understand the wider legal system and the structures that go into either making the law or upholding the law. And obviously I've learned quite a lot from my degree about the intrinsities of how the Scottish legal system and its independence relates to the UK state and obviously the English and Welsh legal system. And I think point one, which often isn't communicated that much within the debate on independence, having your own huge advantage for a transition to independence. Obviously, I don't have the numbers to hand, but I'd imagine, you know, many of the other countries that have transitioned to independence have had the very difficult challenge of having to establish their own independent legal system simultaneously, which obviously involves, you know, having to set up your own judiciary, having to set up your own system of courts and your own hierarchy of courts, and having to develop your own case law, you know, the kind of historic culture of the courts about how they operate and how authority works in terms of making legal judgments, and having to often like uncouple yourself from the previous state. Scotland doesn't have that challenge. Scotland has had its own legal system dating back to 1532, when the establishment of the Court of Session in Edinburgh. So it's got a long and highly respected independent legal culture, which for me symbolises obviously the great intellectual tradition in the Scottish civic society. And there's huge capacity there. There's huge institutional memory. There's great ability and capacity. We've got great universities. We have the ability to run and obviously reform our own legal system. And I feel like that's a good parallel for what we can achieve on the political front.
Here's a question for you, Michael, and because it's topical. Obviously, with Brexit, it looks more and more clear that Boris Johnson is going to toughen up rather than negotiate a compromise on his hard lines as far as Brexit. And it's looking like a crash out on the 31st of October. We were warned by the no side in 2014, a vote for Scottish independence would mean we'd be kicked out of the European Union. We've discovered it's actually the opposite. But from your legal viewpoint and your experience and your study of this, how well prepared do you think Scotland is in its legal system to be fully compatible with the European Union and to re-enter once Scotland becomes independent?
Well, all evidence is that Scotland is currently compatible with the required acquis communautaire of the European Union, and there's obviously various legal and political authorities that back that up, including, I think it was the outgoing representative of the European Union Commission to the UK, Jacqueline Miner, who said to the gathered press in Edinburgh that Scotland would be well placed to essentially be fast-tracked as a full member of the European Union, which for me was an absolutely explosive revelation. It was covered moderately with sort of moderate positivity at the time by some media outlets that were traditionally sort of pro-union, including like the Daily Record and the Scotsman, reported Jacqueline Miner's comments. For me, that was as massive an intervention as the controversial Barroso intervention back in 2013-14, when people were talking about, you know, the difficulties of Scotland becoming a member of the EU. A lot of that has changed. The tone has changed. The view in Brussels has shifted dramatically. When I went over to Brussels not long after the Brexit referendum, I spoke to, for instance, one of the leaders of the Fine Gael Irish delegation, their lead MEP, who was talking about how he'd welcome Scotland with open arms. And that's very much the political culture. There was the standing ovation, of course, for Alan Smith, and himself and others have also been working behind the scenes to sort of build up that political support across the different political groups. So politically, Scotland is well placed. There'd of course be a negotiation around things like the common fisheries policy and questions of sort of opt-outs and finance. But other than that, you know, Scotland, one of the things I often find incredibly frustrating is when some people compare Scottish accession to the EU to the likes of some of the, you know, post-communist states or certain like post-civil war states in the Balkans, which is laughable.
Sure is.
Completely different countries, completely different histories, completely different cultures. Scotland isn't a country that's escaping, you know, extreme authoritarian rule. It's a modern, Western, prosperous, legally sustainable, human rights adhering nation.
The problem
and
is, Michael,
it would not be a large step to become a nation state within the European Union.
The problem is there is that they've got the mainstream media and the BBC, and they can push that message out about Scotland being like these countries.
It's now become a simple message that we can either be a normal European country like the other 27 as we'll be later this year, and with trade deals through the EU, throughout the whole of the world, and with no serious hiccup in there, at a normal European country, or we can be part of the outcast of Europe and of the world for that matter. How do we get that message out, do you think?
I think the simplest message is one of confidence, and I feel like we often have to sort of educate ourselves in the assets, the potential, the strengths that Scotland has in comparison to almost any other country on earth. And it's not about sort of boasting or going over the top, but it's a straightforward comparison. If Scotland was to become an independent country, it would be the richest, most financially agile and experienced, most educated, most technologically gifted new independent country in the history of the world. And that's an incredible foundation to build a nation state upon. So to some degree, the understandable concerns people have about change and new starts and the idea of risk, I think, can be ameliorated by sort of imbuing the debate with that sense of confidence. That Scotland is historically an incredibly wealthy, educated, technologically strong, financially literate country. I think often people don't feel that themselves if you know, they know what's happened to different communities in Scotland over the last 30, 40 years when they've often been gutted by especially by the approach Westminster's had to industrial policy. And I think that can often give people the idea that Scotland is some kind of basket case or some kind of, some kind of beggar nation, which is, of course, not only completely inaccurate, but quite insulting. And I think that is still the sort of fight for Scotland's soul that's ongoing, like whether we move forward as a more confident country or whether we fall back on these old stereotypes.
It's a form of conditioning, really, isn't it, Michael? That if you tell individual people or a whole country that you're really, you don't have the ability to run yourself, and you tell it repeatedly over days, years, decades, centuries, that enough people believe it, that it's a form of self-imprisonment, really. It's how do you break through those bars and get out into the free world. So it's a kind of happy story you're telling.
And just to add one point on the question you asked a minute ago about another point from the sort of legal world, it's something I'm still thinking through, but there's something to learn from the Brexit debate about the discussion of taking back control and how that was described to people, about how people understand how decision-making works. Because the EU, in my opinion, has a soft influence on the domestic legal systems of the UK. There's certain ways that obviously rules are passed through at the EU level that the UK jurisdictions then have to comply with. So because of that soft influence, they had this big marketing campaign saying that we needed to take back control over areas, which in reality was about issues like, food labelling and environmental policy and, of course, fishing and things like that, which are important areas, but they're not the major issues that affect most people's day-to-day life. You look at the debate over Scotland, and you look at the things that the Scottish Parliament is blocked from taking action on, and you're talking about things like, people's welfare, people's rights over disability support, obviously people's taxes, and the majority of taxpayers are still reserved. You're looking at foreign policy, you're looking at Trident, the things we all know about. But the Scottish Parliament is incredibly constrained in its ability to make decisions over even some minor matters, things like talking about the legal system being independent, but the pay of judges is explicitly reserved within the Scotland Act 1998. It is against the law for the Scottish government, apparently the most powerful devolved parliament in the world, to change the salary of judges. Until recently, of course, notoriously, it was parking, or was it road safety and signage was still reserved until it was devolved under the 2012 Act. And I think there has to be a way of communicating often the ridiculousness of of how tight some of these reserve powers operate in practice, to kind of explain to people that, yes, often the Scottish Parliament does have power, does have influence, it does have resources, but in many ways it's still quite tightly legally constrained.
And also on the taking back power, there's the real key question in there is who's getting this power? Who's it been taken back and given to? Under Brexit and under what happened yesterday, well, there we have a cabinet led by millionaires, some of whom, Jacob Rees-Mogg, moved his company overseas, has done quite many of them done very nicely. It is dominated by Leave campaigners, the senior members of the Vote Leave campaign, and they have got things set up so that they will take back control of the finance, and they will make a fortune out of it. Whereas in Scotland, I think we mean something kind of different. If we ever use the term take back control, what we're saying is the ordinary people of the country take back control of their own country and have a say in what their own future should be, as opposed to just getting telt.
I think so. There's a lot of work in that area, and that's definitely one area I'll be working with Robert and the stuff we're putting out with Scotia, and to try and make it more digestible. So I think the legal profession in Scotland often takes some of these things for granted, and the sort of legal experts, like, we're taught in quite simple language that the Westminster Parliament is supreme. You have the supremacy of the British Parliament and the British legislature. So when we were discussing things like the EU withdrawal bill and, you know, the power grab back to Westminster, it's almost seen as uncontroversial that, well, of course, Westminster can just redefine Scotland's powers without consent, without permission. Like, sure, there's the Sewell Convention, and by convention they try and reach agreement, but it wasn't seen as this great breach of constitutional law or on principle that Westminster was altering the Scotland Act without consent, when really it should be. Really, it should be seen as an outrage, not only within the legal community, but within the national media.
This really bothers me, Michael. It's like, it seems to be, doesn't matter what laws are passed by Scottish Parliament, they can be overturned. Everything can be overturned. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's the implications of that? You know, if you want to.
Yeah, it's huge. That was actually the main reason I went to do a law degree. It
Good
was
man.
From
that out for
when
us.
I was working in the Scottish Parliament following this land reform debate. There was a law, and some people that maybe have an interest in land reform and ownership of land will remember the debates. You know, it was one of the few, I think, possibly. You know, the currency debate recently at S&P conference is another example, but barring that, I think it's the only issue that I can remember the S&P leadership losing on at S&P conference was when the membership voted for greater action on land reform. So I was following that debate closely in Parliament, and the one major reason why the government was tentative about pushing further on land reform was fear about a legal challenge in the courts, and the convener of the, what was at the time, the Rural Affairs and Climate Change Committee, Rob Gibson, MSP, told me openly on the record in a long interview I did with him that he saw it as inevitable that piece of legislation, what became the Land Reform Scotland Act 2016, would be taken to the courts and challenged on by landowners. And the way the Scottish Parliament operates, it is particularly sensitive to legal challenges, far more sensitive and open to legal challenge than the Westminster Parliament is. Acts of the Westminster Parliament are subject to challenge under the Human Rights Act, so they generally have to, they aim to be compatible with sort of broader human rights. And so often they'll be back and forward about whether a certain piece of legislation is compatible with human rights guidelines, which can be challenged at the European Council or the Council of Europe as court. So they can be challenged on that, but they can automatically be overturned. So you look at something like prisoner voting rights. So it was found that the UK government was, or the UK Parliament's legislation was incompatible with human rights grounds because it had a blanket ban on prisoner voting. But the UK Parliament just ignored it. They ignored that judgment. They didn't overnight embrace prisoner voting, and then they tweaked it slightly to try and sort of meet this human rights threshold. They can generally dance away from legal opposition. The courts can't veto Westminster law. It's completely different in a Scottish context. The number one reason that Scotland will be bringing in more prisoner voting in the franchise bill that's currently being considered through the Scottish Parliament is that it has to, by law, absolutely abide by human rights law and the European Convention of Human Rights. Every act of the Scottish Government and every piece of legislation has to be compatible. If it's not compatible, it can be struck down in the courts. And that's only one ground. Struck down in the courts if it breaches any of that. And that's happened a few times. It happened on named person in particular, although that was on a technicality. And it happened on land reform in the 2003 Agricultural Holdings Act. Part of that act was struck down. Breaching the human rights of landlords.
Let me pick up on some of the things you said in there. There's a lot of people, especially undecided people and independents, who say, you know what, we're almost independent, we don't need to go the whole hog, but we're close enough to it, we've got lots of powers, we've got a secure, stable Scottish Parliament, it's been in existence 20 years, that's good enough. For as long as it's there with those powers, I'll be happy. And here's the point that I'm making, or the question that I'm putting, for as long as it's there. Is the key point. I actually went out and got a copy of the bill established in the Scottish Parliament when it was published in 1998, read it end to end. I was delighted with it because what it said was the Scottish Parliament will have powers over absolutely everything except for things listed. And you've mentioned some of them earlier on that have changed over the years. But there was a list of reserved powers, but everything else other than that was Scottish Parliament. And if a whole new subject came up, you know, the regularisation of aliens landing in Glasgow Green, it hadn't been anticipated then, so it goes to Scottish Parliament. Right, but you've just given an example in there because of the power grab, and that's a term used quite a lot, the power grab, where with Brexit, powers come back from Europe to be dealt with in the UK. But there's the thing. The Scottish Act should have meant that those powers would have come to the Scottish Parliament and instead they've been grabbed and taken to Westminster instead. Question then for you, how stable, how secure is this reasonable compromise of a devolved Scottish Parliament in the long term? Is it safe for the people who previously said, that's good enough for now, I'll stick with it and I won't go the whole hog? Is it safe for them to still continue saying that, or do they have to start thinking beyond that?
It's not. So I think these are often the things we have to understand to run a more effective campaign in the future. Because I think, obviously, so many people that were pro-independence were probably quite, obviously, I was, not to show off, but I was, I think I would have been six, I think, or something like that, the day Scotland voted for a parliament. But I think from conversation, I'm informed that most people saw it obviously as a happy occasion, as a landmark, as progress for Scotland. And so it was a time for celebration when Scotland got its parliament back. But like you say, it was seen often as in some ways generous with the way powers were devolved. But I think the reality behind the scenes is sinister is maybe a strong word, but I think in many ways the Scottish Parliament is neutered by the Scotland Act. I think the powers it has are not fully effective powers in the way that we talk about the powers Westminster has. Because when Westminster uses its powers, it knows it can't be overruled by the courts. It can't be vetoed by the courts. Acts of the Scottish Parliament or the Scottish Government can be vetoed by the courts for any number of reasons. They can be vetoed, as we said, on human rights grounds. They can be vetoed if they're seen to contradict reserved powers. And they can be challenged and delayed in the courts by the UK government, and that's extreme. So that's what we saw immediately over. So not only did we have the power grab, we had the vetoing, essentially, of the continuity bill. So before the power grab came into effect, the Scottish Parliament tried to pass its own continuity bill to regulate the powers that it had by law under the Scotland Act. And first of all, that bill was delayed, because the UK government has this power to fast-track any piece of devolved legislation to the courts. to the Supreme Court. So they immediately put in a challenge on the view that they wish to challenge the legislation by saying that it wasn't devolved, it was reserved. And people might, who are maybe really closely focused on these types of debates, might remember that controversially the presiding officer, Ken McIntosh, with legal advice, put out an opinion saying that he thought the bill was outside competence, was in legal terms ultra vires, which means like out with the powers of the Parliament.
I could cry here. A legal
challenge, and during that legal challenge, that's when the UK government changed the Scotland Act and basically vetoed and said, we're going to change the Scotland Act and block this legislation.
Yep.
So we've got
the news coming in, Michael.
About
it's going to put us off.
If that's what Westminster does, and essentially can veto any act of the Parliament retrospectively.
Yep.
Okay, Michael, we've got the news coming up, so we're all going to get booted off. Listen, we me and Greg will be chatting to you soon, right, about what you're doing. Okay, we love it. And that was so fascinating.
Very good, Michael. And thank you for that.
It's great to have a lawyer. Michael on my side, isn't it? I think we could be going to him for other stuff. Okay, mate, listen, take care, and we'll catch up soon, okay?
Cheers, Michael.
Great work. Keep it up, guys.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
IndieLive.radio.